Hey, Trustmaker listeners, if you're a fan of this show, then you'll love Touch of Truth, a new podcast from part-time Trustmakers host Jackie Cooper. In this special 8-part series, Jackie explores what it means to be vulnerable in one of the world's most curated industries. New episodes come out every Tuesday on touchoftruthpod.com.
Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trustmakers.
I'm Amanda Edelman, COO of the Gen Z Lab and Associate Director at Edelman. Earlier this week, the Edelman Trust Institute released their second annual publication, Restoring Trust in a Fractured World. In this compendium of 9 essays, contributors reflect on polarization around the world and offer solutions for rebuilding trust and restoring our social fabric. We're so excited to have one of our esteemed contributors, Manu Mehl, join us today. Manu is the CEO of Bridge USA, a youth-led nonprofit organization that creates spaces on high school and college campuses for open discussion between students about political issues. Manu, welcome to the Trustmakers.
Amanda, thanks so much for having me. Appreciate you all giving us a chance to talk about our work.
Absolutely. So first question, we'll start nice and easy. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved with Bridge USA?
Yeah, thanks for that question. You know, what's interesting is that I had no interest in like politics or democracy or any of the stuff that Bridge USA does. I was a pre-med student. I actually have less of an interest in politics now doing this work. You know, I was a freshman at UC Berkeley in February of 2017, Amanda. We had these massive free speech protests because this speaker by the name of Milo Yiannopoulos, who is this like conservative provocateur, came to campus.
And of course, I remember him. Yeah,
exactly. And it led to what was the largest protest in Berkeley since the 60s. And the next day, me and some random folks that are now some of my best friends, we basically thought, man, like, there's not only a lack of trust, but people are just very angry, and there's a lot of resentment, and there's a lot of pessimism. And so we created a space for people to just listen and talk to each other, and the rest is history.
That's amazing. And when you first did it, how was it received on a campus like Berkeley? I have to say, you know, Berkeley is perceived as a very progressive place. So were people initially excited that you were creating space for political dialogue, or was there initially some pushback?
That's a great question, because Bridge USA works on campuses across the country. And so you'll have like some super conservative campuses, some very middle of the road campuses. You'll have progressive campuses. Berkeley, as you know, sometimes is called the Republic of California. And you know, that first discussion was fascinating. I came into that discussion having no idea what was going to happen. Again, I was like this pre-med student with really not much of an understanding of democracy or all the complex issues we were going to talk about. But one thing that does not change about people, regardless of whether they live in very progressive places or that they live in very conservative places, is that they're people at the end of the day. And it turns out that people like to talk to people in constructive environments that are safe and productive. And that's what we did with that space. And I was shocked. You know, that first discussion, we had like 70 or 80 people show up, which for me at that time was a lot of folks, after we like disseminated random flyers in our dorm rooms. And people left that discussion not necessarily agreeing, but they had understanding. And that's, I think, the core of Bridge is we're not trying to get everybody to agree on everything. We're not trying to help them all get along. We're trying to help people understand the humanity and the common goodness that exists within people, especially those that they might disagree with.
And is there any, can you tell me a little bit more about the philosophy behind Bridge, and in particular, why you decided to focus on college campuses? And if you have any thoughts about if you want to expand to different age groups or anything like that.
I don't even think we have a philosophy, because what we do is not unique or different. To me, we're doing the most basic work that exists in society, which is that we help people talk to each other. That's it. And the fact that at this moment, that seems provocative or that seems something that's needed is such a sad point for where we are as a country and as a group of people. The simple assumption behind Bridge is that democracy cannot exist if we can't talk to each other. We do not have a society. We cannot solve our problems. We cannot engage if we don't know how to build coalitions, if we don't know how to understand, if we don't know how to engage. The second assumption, Amanda, behind Bridge, people are looking for identity. I think a lot of people feel isolated. People are scared to talk about their opinions. People are scared to be judged, especially with our social media environment. And so our job is to fill that deep desire for trust, for productive dialogue, for conversation. And at the core, again, as I've said, This work is about building a tent of people that are guided by three things. And those three things are, we have to be open-minded as opposed to being closed-minded. We have to be curious as opposed to being oppositional. And we have to be empathetic as opposed to being exclusive. And as a young person that's like 23 years old, that stuff sounds basic to me. That's like what we do in our families, you know, and as friends. Yeah. Like, it doesn't seem that complex. To me, it's not a philosophy. To me, it's a way of life.
Yeah, absolutely. It sort of reminds me of, you know, all the jokes that people have. Oh, did you skip kindergarten when you can't share? I agree with you. You know, these findings are pretty, or these values are very commonplace. But I agree. It's surprising to see. Unfortunately, they're not reflected necessarily across all places in the world. I absolutely love this. So basically, you're creating sort of groups of people and sort of safe spaces for people to really get into it and really talk about things and issues that are taboo, that are uncomfortable. Can you give maybe a couple of examples of sessions that you've created or facilitated that have gone really well, or maybe some that have gone less well, and just things that you've learned from it?
So there's one thing I'm going to push back on just a little bit, which is the word safe spaces. You know, for us, because that phrase has become so politicized, like almost everything has, whether it's free speech or safe spaces or change or progress, the first thing we do is we just don't use those words. And part of the reason is I mean, the work that you all have done through Edelman, the trust barometer that you all have released that shows how mistrusting people are, especially at this moment, I think people are looking for reasons to say no. And our job is to be as open as possible to get the maximum amount of people into the room. So that's the first thing I would say. In terms of discussions and dialogues, let me just get really tactical for a second. So Bridge USA currently has 50 college chapters, 20 high school chapters. The goal of a college chapter or high school chapter is creating a space within campus. We call them civic spaces. Basically, just like in cities, how we have green spaces, this is an environment for you to be able to constructively engage and talk about issues that are very difficult, or talk about issues like whether or not a hot dog is a sandwich. You know, we don't need to build trust over the most divisive issues. We can build trust on a lot of different things. The most important thing that our students are doing is they're helping people see the possibility of conversation with people that are different than ourselves. Because I think we live in this moment right now where a dialogue with someone that's different than you just sounds like a life-sucking experience. Like no one is like getting out of bed being like, I want to have an ideological brawl today, right? And so when the biggest criticism we often face is like, do people actually change their minds? And I think that's the wrong question. I think the most important thing is that we've, again, forgotten the ability to communicate, which is so important to us as people.
So then how do you define success at the end of a session? If it's not to change people's minds on a certain thing, then what's the goal?
The first success point is that the conversation doesn't blow up. Because right now, we're not even there as a society at that point. Like, the reason why I describe Bridge in such simple terms is because right now, if you look around and I ask you, like, when was the last time we had a conversation with someone that was different than us? Most people will not have an answer to that question. So the first is just basic. It's like having a space where the dialogue proceeds, whether you're on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook or online or podcast, people devolve into arguments all the time. The second success point in a discussion is, are people able to say one positive thing about someone that's different than them? And importantly, are people able to find valid truths in other people's lived experiences? Because I think we have this mentality right now where my experience is the truth, but you must have some bankrupt views. But importantly, if I can say, like, Amanda, you've got a real experience that informs the reason why you think a certain thing, that suddenly humanizes you as a person. And that is very powerful. I think it's a prerequisite, Amanda, to even creating consensus.
Yeah. I mean, I like what you're saying too, because clearly you don't have a defined objective, or you don't have a defined way you're trying to take people's views. So you're allowing sort of for multiple truths or multiple viewpoints.
The defined objective, I'll just say, is I think part of the problem right now is that in the past, we used to be very nervous about just saying that we get people to talk to each other, because that sounds like a very amorphous concept. But I think the fact that we've grown so quickly and the fact that we've had such fast and rapid success in terms of engaging young people, I think shows to me that that in and of itself is an objective that we have to strive for, because we don't have anything else as a society if we don't know how to engage.
Yeah. What do you do in a tricky circumstance where people's views are completely at odds? You know, like you have someone, for example, who's a queer person with someone who doesn't believe in gay marriage or whatever those two things that are fundamentally at odds are. How do you mediate in a circumstance like that where two people sort of with their lived experiences are fundamentally believing that they have the moral high ground and that their view is right and no one else's can be? What do you do in a really tricky situation like that?
We failed more times than we've succeeded, which has helped us figure out how to deal with those situations. You know, I don't want to be that guy that's just like, roses and sunshines, conversations are great. Oh yeah, sometimes they're extraordinarily difficult. I mean, you brought the example of a queer person that's engaging with someone that questions their identity. I would say two things to that specific example. The first is I often get asked, are you in the business of telling people that might be at a marginalized position to engage with someone that might not be in that marginalized position? And I would actually say no. What I'm in the position of doing is telling their allies to be in conversation. I'm not telling the African-American student in Chicago that's been beaten down generation after generation with poverty to necessarily have or be forced to have a conversation with someone that questions their lived experience. But I'm in the business of telling their white allies to have that dialogue because someone's got to have that conversation. Because someone has to create that bridge. Someone has to be willing to engage. Someone has to be willing to actually try to break that fourth wall. The second thing I would say is that, again, this is about trust. Our discussions and our chapters on campus have built significant inroads and connections with other student organizations, with the Black Student Union, the Latinx groups, the identity groups, the conservative students on campus, the free speech societies. And so when you have that trust entering a conversation, suddenly people are more willing to engage.
So when you facilitate sessions like this, how much of that sort of philosophical human experience, this is who we are as people, how much of that do you imbue into these sessions? Is, you know, is that a sort of a fundamental part of the facilitation in order to recognize, have other people sort of recognize each other's mutual humanity? Or do you say, or do you think that underpins sort of what you're doing and it's less explicit in the facilitation?
Yeah, there's the short answer is I think it's less explicit because we gradually, when people feel comfortable, they're willing to share. Like right now, I feel very comfortable with you and I'll talk to you about my life story if you want to ask, right? Like, when we get comfortable, we want the other person to be like, you want to be heard. You want to be seen. Like, again, that's why this stuff is not that complicated to me. But there's two things we do to ensure that that space elicits that product, that it elicits that emotional affect within people. The first is that all of our discussions are led by fellow students. So there's no power dynamic. It's students with students, whether it's high school students with high school students, it's college students with the college students, because they know their communities best. So you got to have a trained moderator because sometimes these conversations can go awry and you can do more harm. So you want to have a trained moderator whose job is to help flow that conversation, to ask some of those questions, to help people, if someone feels attacked, to stand up for them. If someone else feels like you're being a little biased, to get the other way. Mm-hmm. The second thing we do is we have our norms of discussion and we have four norms of discussions. You got to listen, not to respond. Everyone represents themselves and not larger groups. So I'm an Indian person. I'm talking about my policies and my ideas, but I don't speak for all Indian Americans because oftentimes when we get into these group identities, it all gets conflictual. The third thing is you got to let the other person finish their thought. And finally is you have to lead with empathy. Because you winning in the space is not going to lead to any progress. There's other places to do that. This is a space for you to better yourself.
Yeah. Is there anything around assuming positive intent? Like that's in sort of the tricky dialogues that I've engaged in. That's always been a fundamental tenet, is asking people to assume positive intent of others. And for myself, assuming positive intent. So if someone says something that I don't necessarily agree with, I am assuming it didn't come from a bad place. They didn't mean it maliciously. It's just out of ignorance or misunderstanding, or I interpreted it a different way than the person intended. Is that sort of part of the philosophy as well?
Yeah, I think it depends on the space you're in. You know, if you're in Congress and you're debating a legislation, it might not be best to achieve, assume positive intent. If you're in a boardroom and you're trying to pass a certain a package for your employees, you have a different intention there. In bridge discussions, our goal is to help foster positive intent. So I think it depends on the space that you're entering. And our job is to create a brand around trust and positive intention so that when people are entering, they know that they're not going to be attacked. And that way, they don't also have to approach with their guard up, which is why our work is both very simple, but very difficult, because it's trying to help people assume and lead with trust in a moment where everything seems so fractious.
Absolutely. So actually, I want to slightly pivot the conversation a bit. to one of your other goals, which is sort of helping companies and other organizations have conversations like this. And for Edelman, for example, we've done a lot of trust studies on trust in the workplace and have seen what we call the workplace being an island of civility, quote unquote. So actually in sort of the conversations that you're describing of creating a place where people can engage in productive dialogue, it turns out that a lot of workers across the US and globally think the same thing about their workplace. And for me, initially, I see similarities there, which is that there are, you know, multiple viewpoints represented, political viewpoints, people from different gender, race, sexuality backgrounds, what have you. But there's also a bit of guidelines and parameters. Like in what you organize, it's obviously there's an organizer there. There are people to make sure the conversation flows in a certain way. And in the workplace, there are certain norms that people must adhere to make sure that, you know, conversation doesn't get too uncivil or doesn't go, you know, too, it doesn't get too heated or visceral one way or the other. So I'm curious if you see any parallels there between sort of a workplace conversation and the work that you are doing too.
It's a very insightful question because I think it gets at a parallelism that we've seen throughout society. In earlier this year, two professors that we've worked with in the past, Julia Minson and Francesca Gino, put out the cover story that Harvard Business Review was managing a polarized workforce. Mm. And like, that's my work. And so I got to check it out. And the entire article was talking about how one of the challenges that workplaces face is that a lot of the leadership is often much older and a lot of the entry work talent is much younger. And so there's a lot of conflict in values. There's a lot of misunderstanding and everybody's walking on eggshells. You know, the amount of times that workplaces have had to come out and say that we can't talk about politics, it's just an example that they see that as an impediment to their progress. Here's why I think workplaces are so important in this moment. And I write about this in the piece that y'all really kindly published for us, which was that outside of the classroom, I don't think there's another place in society where people are naturally working towards a common solution or goal with people that are different than them. Hmm. Like to me, it's the workplace and it's the educational system. And I would even pose that question to you. Like I've thought about this a lot because this point of alienation and isolation is very prevalent throughout our work. And like, where are people meeting people that are different than them? That might be from different places, different environments, different backgrounds, that isn't the workplace and that isn't school?
That is such a good question. I completely agree. It's funny. I actually, this is a silly example, but I remember many years ago, I took a quiz from the New York Times about where you should live based on political affiliation. And there's actually very few places across the United States that have a diverse political environment. Most places are incredibly politically homogenous and increasingly so. So sort of as an example of that, it's like where people live, the neighborhoods that people choose to associate in, the cities even that people choose to live in are becoming increasingly politically homogenous. So to your point, if you're part of a broader organization where you're meeting people from different geographies, like that's really where you're exposed to different points of view.
And I would say that's not a silly example. I think that's a perfect example, Amanda. I mean, it touches on like, do you know how many times I get asked the question, or people will say like, we're headed for a civil war. And the only way to avoid that civil war is let's just live in states where everybody agrees with us. So you have this like geographic sorting happening in our politics.
That
right
makes
now.
Me so sad.
That's insane. And I'll just say, cap this off with this point, which is, you that's working in the corporate workplace knows that studies after studies have shown that the best ways to create effective teams is have them be diverse teams. And I don't just mean this diversity in terms of identity and demographics, but diversity in the ways that we approach our ideological beliefs, diversity in the way that we think about the world, because that helps you be maybe more risk averse. Maybe that helps you be more forward thinking. So it's essential, I think, to productivity, to innovation, and to creating a better environment in the business world.
Absolutely. And so basically what you're saying is that it's critical for businesses to engage or at least to facilitate sort of these conversations and facilitate having ideologically diverse teams, because outside of school, this is really the only other arena in which people are working towards a common goal and sort of have the necessary fundamentals to ensure that diverse perspectives are being heard.
And if that doesn't do it for you, the other point is that we are increasingly headed towards a moment where when it comes to the workplace, when it comes to school environments, when it comes to educational places, people are searching for community. Like, people are looking for community, and business and politics are no longer separate.
Yeah,
quiet absolutely. Quitting is like the perfect trend to explain that.
Quiet quitting, absolutely. It's
just another example.
I completely agree. And it's funny, I do a lot of work around Gen Z, and I've recently done a number of presentations where the takeaway is that action earns trust. And so businesses are more and more needing to step into the void sort of left by other pillars of society and act across societal issues. And a lot of the reason for that is that consumer, employee, sort of stakeholder expectations are changing, driven by Gen Z, driven by young people. And so that's what I want to focus sort of the remaining third of our conversation on, is around Gen Z and sort of how they're viewing politics and political debate. Something that I have seen, and I actually wrote a bit about this in an article in Fortune around Gen Z in the midterms, is that Gen Z isn't ideological. They're not political in that, you know, the majority of them are registered for Republicans or Democrats. Broadly speaking, they vote in higher numbers for Democrats, but they have certain issues that they're interested in. So it's less that they vote, you know, down ballot for Democrats, is that they're interested in gun safety, climate change, et cetera. So is that something that you've experienced? It's, instead of people sort of identifying in a partisan way, they have principles that they're adhering to.
I love that. And that actually, you basically took like half the answer from me. I would actually, let me ask you this before I respond to that, which is in your work and maybe in writing that article and what you've seen, have you felt like young people, what is your thought on like how comfortable our generation is in talking about, or Gen Z is in talking about politics, or feeling, do you feel like people are generally dissatisfied? Do you feel like people are optimistic? Like, what's your take on that? I'm curious.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think broadly speaking, I think the generation is not satisfied with politics, is not optimistic, but the way that they approach politics makes me very optimistic in that they have relatively high voting patterns. They're an extremely activist oriented generation that wants accountability and transparency from politicians, from brands. And I think for me, the dissatisfaction that Gen Z feels is leading to necessary action. So their sort of lack of optimism makes me optimistic as a result.
Yeah.
Is that something that you experience too?
Yeah. You know, I think that BridgeUSA's work is no longer about ideological division. I'll give you a quick example of this. We have our student summit every year. And so the last summit was in April of this year, actually. And we had student leaders from all of our college campuses, and we had like really conservative students from like Louisiana and Texas. And we had, you know, some trans students from like Georgia, and we had like really ideological liberals from New York. Mm-hmm. And we had crazy people like me from Berkeley. And it was an environment where like people had passionate disagreements. People are passionate about their ideas, but they were all also incredibly happy and excited about the Bridge mission. And that was confusing for me because I don't see that a lot in our country and in our society. And to your point, I think it's because we're no longer in an ideological battle. I think we're in a battle of temperament and principles. We often think about politics on the x-axis, left-right, but this group did not exist on the left-right. They were all over the place on the left-right axis. So our thought is, what if there's a y-axis to our politics with, you know, crazy exclusionary politics at the top where only we have to win and everybody else sucks, and all the way at the bottom, you have apathy and disengagement. I think our job is to get the temperamental middle, but anywhere on the ideological spectrum. And so when I say that we're in a temperamental battle, I think the BridgeUSA tent is a tent of, are you open-minded? Are you willing to be curious? And are you willing to be empathetic? That to me is a temperamental middle. And everybody else that's focused on being closed-minded, that's focused on exclusion, and that's focused on creating spaces that push people out, are not in that tent. And I think when we reshape our political access and our fight to that, I think not only do you create the conditions for common progress, but you move away from ideology and you move to something higher. And I think that higher identity is very strong, especially at this moment.
I absolutely love that. And this really dovetails with a lot of the data that we've done around Gen Z, which is that A, the generation is very globally unified, and B, the generation is all about the we, not the me. And I think you can really see that in some of their voting patterns, which is this generation, to your point, politically inclusive, sort of aligned with a number of causes across the world. Globally, the generation, for example, really cares about climate change, really cares about social justice, mental health. And these are sort of higher principles that I think, unfortunately, have become partisan and politicized, at least in the US. But I think for a lot of youth and Gen Z, I would imagine that people in that temperamental middle, regardless of political ideology, are all aligned towards, you know, a more inclusive system, a more inclusive world.
Well, there's one thing I would caveat a little bit, which is that I wouldn't necessarily put issue buckets into the temperamental middle. So like I wouldn't, and again, it's because we live in such a politicized climate, right? So if I said that the temperamental middle supports action on climate and believes in social justice, I just lost half the country. Regardless of what I just had to say next, because again, everybody's so locked in an ideological battle. So what we have to do is we have to describe the temperamental middle, I think, in how is it that you want to create change? Because right now, if someone that's listening to this, that's especially conservative, is going to think, well, then all you're doing is you're just bridging with liberals. And you're just trying to get everybody else to agree with their principles. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to help conservatives and liberals see the value in each other's ideas so that we can create progress on the issues that we care about. But me saying that we got to create common understanding on our ideas and find value in what each other has to say, I think that's the battle, because so many people are refusing to do that. Because I think we live in such a hyper-politicized moment that has so many people's identities at risk that asking folks to do that is in and of itself a problematic statement.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever get pushback that you are not doing enough? The only reason I ask is because you went to Berkeley, I went to Stanford. I did student government, so sort of similarly had a lot of insight into how strongly people advocate for issues that they care about, as people should. That's great. But do people feel like by appealing to the broad, you know, the moderate middle or sort of like the broader swath of people, you're not necessarily doing enough?
First of all, I get pushback all the time. So you should push back as much as yeah. as much as you as
like,
much
I've
as you'd like
before,
to.
Right?
If I wasn't getting pushback, then I wouldn't be doing something worth doing. So here's the interesting thing about the moderate middle. You know, I think especially with young people my age and people that are younger than me, when you hear the word moderate, I think it immediately screams like squishy milquetoast person that doesn't believe anything. And this is a dose of like intellectual humility that I would bring to my generation. And this is where I do get pushback. The 60s was one of the most progressive generations in American history. Anti-war protests, MLK, RFK, JFK. You had civil rights action across the board. They were the people that at that time were on the side of free speech. That generation is the generation that's now in power that we criticize so much. Mm-hmm. So just because you hold progressive beliefs and believe that we got to constantly move forward does not immediately put you on the right side of history. I think what we as a generation have to realize is, yes, there's issues that we have to fight for. Yes, there's things that matter to us. The question is, how are you going to fight for those issues? And that's the battle line for us. Are you going to fight those issues by creating coalitions that bring everybody together? Or are you going to fight that at the expense of excluding people? I mean this for both the left and the right. Mm. Are you going to fight those issues with a value set that people that might disagree with us can still come along? We just got to work with them a little bit harder. Or are you going to fight those issues by pushing those people out? And importantly, are you going to give people a chance to be better in that process? Because right now we are so quick to make moral judgments about each other, when what we have to realize is that the worst judgment we can make is to assume that you believe something perniciously and not maybe because you've lived in an environment that has taught you certain things. We just got to give people a chance to be better. And that's the problem we all face. We're on a knife's edge at our own doing. And that to me is so tragic.
Yeah. Manu, that was so insightful and incredible. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. But Manu, thank you so much for sharing your insights and expertise. And to our listeners, thank you so much for listening to The Trustmakers.
Amanda, thanks so much for having me. And thank you to all the work that y'all are doing. Check out the Edelman Trust Barometer. Check out the Gen Z Lab. I love it. So I appreciate you. Thank you for all you do.
Absolutely.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.